Welcome to another episode of the Middle West Podcast. I'm your host, Taqib Musa. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you all. I'm joined today in this roundtable by two of the other hosts at the Middle West Podcast, part of our team. Hamda Muhammad, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Hamda, where are you joining us from in this remote thing? You look like you're in front of some palace, but I assume that's not true.
Oh, no, I'm in my bedroom. I wish I was in Budapest, but I'm not. I'm joining you from gloomy Birmingham.
Okay, I wouldn't put Birmingham down so easily. It's a great place.
Mate, it's the weather. Can you see it? It's literally just grey skies today.
Fair enough. I haven't been outside yet. We also have with us, joining us from the car, so you can actually see the weather in his case, Mustafa, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam. Yes, I'm in the car and it's arguably better than Birmingham.
Why have you been relegated?
Why are you attacking Birmingham now?
Yeah, how can you just start? We've been off for air for like 4 weeks and you come in and the first thing you say is you hate Birmingham. It's unacceptable. You know, a lot of our audience is actually from Birmingham.
You're putting words in my mouth. I said I'm in my car, which is better than Birmingham. Doesn't mean I hate Birmingham. It means I just prefer my car.
Actually, it depends on your car, I guess. You know, if you have some Merc or something. If you've been Abdul Samir buying German executive saloons through tax evasion, then...
Or as he
likes to call it, tax minimization, because that's legal. Tax efficiency.
I just prefer my car to Birmingham. So that's just... I didn't say I dislike Birmingham.
Why have you been relegated to your car, though? Why aren't you in, like...
Because my family... my brother and my father are working from home.
I thought you were going to say my family doesn't like me, and I was going to say, yeah, I kind of get
that too. But they're working from home, and I have nowhere else to do the recording. So I thought I'd do it in the car with my heated... I would say heated seats, but I don't have heated seats.
I thought you were going to do a little bit of a flex there. Humble brag. Look at me. I work hard. I got this car with the heated seats.
And afford these luxuries.
Yeah. Well, a car in and of itself is a luxury. So.
Alhamdulillah.
And how's lockdown keeping? We were very close to launching our podcast properly because we were allowed to meet at six. And then this multi-tier lockdown system came in. And to be honest, I've been... unable physically to keep up with the new lockdown regulations because they're so confusing. So I think I'm following them, but I may or may not be because everything is so confusing.
I think that's the problem a lot of people face. The mixed messaging, the confusion that's coming out of both central government and some local authorities. Some local authorities don't even know what the regulations are until the very last minute. So I think that's definitely added to a lot of the confusion. It's different for the both of you in thinking Birmingham compared to me in London. So I don't know what tier you're in, but
tier two going on to tier three.
Oh, are we in tier three now?
We're going to go into tier three apparently next week. So if we're planning on any, you know, expeditions outside to go to the shops anytime soon, we might as well do that before we go into tier three.
Do that because next week coronavirus is going to say to itself, oh no, I need to go and infect more people.
Yeah.
So definitely do everything you need to do this week.
So basically move your shares from any other company into Amazon again because Jeff Bezos is about to make a killing.
Yes, exactly.
He already has, yes. I think he's made more money than I'm going to make in my lifetime in these past 6 months. But we're not here to talk about...
I wonder if he would like to give us some.
I think multiple lifetimes happen.
Oh, dear.
Are you
putting me down now?
Yes, I don't think you'll earn 16 billion or however much is.
Wait,
you never know what kind of ideas Thaqib could have in his brain. It could be a billionaire tomorrow.
If I do become a billionaire, you're not invited to my house.
I am, right? Because I need the money. I defended you here.
well.
Looking out for myself.
Listen. If, you know, if we're following the teachings of, you know, our great political leader, Jeremy Corbyn, billionaires shouldn't exist. So... I think this is a very interesting point that you make, right?
Jeremy Corbyn, he's been in the news recently. He... former leader of the party, his downfall has been so like how the mighty have fallen, right? He's fallen to the extent that he's suspended from the party now. For this,
I actually don't understand that. Why was there a need to suspend him?
So the inquiry came out on anti-Semitism, saying that there was a lot of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. He posted a statement out saying, "I don't deny there's a problem. There's definitely a problem, but the amount of Islamophobia and the amount of victims, the number of victims,
anti-Semitism, not Islamophobia.
Sorry, yes, I meant anti-Semitism. I was gonna say I have to pick my words very carefully because this sort of pedantic stuff is what he was picked up for, and then I just messed it up there. So." He said that the amount of victims of anti-Semitism is greatly exaggerated, or exaggerated.
He didn't say that. He didn't say that. He's let's not put words in the guy's exactly. mouth.
I think the words were exaggerated.
He's done enough damage. I think he's done enough damage to himself by that statement. I think what he was saying is he was minimizing the extent of anti-Semitism. Essentially, one of the findings that the report had made was that anti-Semitism in the Labour Party under his leadership was the amount of incidents was very, very, very high. And what I think what Jeremy Corbyn said in his statement was, I welcome the results of the inquiry, but I believe it was overinflated by those in the media and those in the political sphere. And I think that is very problematic.
Think it's problematic? So this is what he said exactly, right, on his Facebook. "One anti-Semite is one too many, but the scale of the problem was also dramatically overstated for political reasons by our opponents inside and outside the party, as well as by much of the media."
Yeah, I think to an extent that is problematic, because it can be seen to be reductive.
The point is, this guy is a guy who, for his whole life, I mean, again, I'm not some Jeremy Corbyn fanboy, but at the same time, his claim is that, look, I've stood my whole life standing against racism. So how can you just kick
no
a
one,
guy
no
out?
One's denying that. No one's denying that. He got kicked out of the party after he issued that statement.
Yeah.
So if he did not issue that statement, he wouldn't have got kicked out.
Well, God knows.
Yes, a lot of people are saying we
can't make that inference, but.
But he's also even in that statement, he agreed that there is an anti-Semitism problem. He just said that the extent of it was exaggerated. He's saying that that's a factual statement, right? He's saying that happened, not that there isn't a problem. There is a problem that's been exaggerated.
Yeah, I think, look, that's a fair opinion to have, but I think let's switch it up and take it from the lens of Islamophobia, so maybe we can relate and some of our listeners can relate. Islamophobia, as we know, is rampant in the Conservative Party. And I think as a Muslim, if someone in the Conservative Party was to come out and address it and say, yes, we have Islamophobia in our party, but you're overreacting and making it worse than what it is, that doesn't
let's be very realistic, though, right? What the Conservative Party is actually saying is there is no Islamophobia in the Conservative Party because they did an inquiry and they just said open and shut, no problem, move on. Nothing to see here.
Which is even worse.
So a lot of Muslims are walking around saying that there seems to be this double standard, right? Is when it comes to Islamophobia, everyone's like, yeah, no problem, move on. It's not a thing. Whereas when it comes to anti-Semitism, everyone's up in arms, as they should be, but they should be up in arms about both things. You can't pick and choose your outrage. It's a selective outrage.
Oh yeah, no, of course, but that doesn't mean you be reductive to other forms of discrimination and other forms of just because someone or a party or an entity is denying Islamophobia or is denying anti-Black racism or is denying classism or whatever it is, that doesn't mean we then turn around and say, oh, but the other stuff that you're complaining about, then that doesn't exist as well. Do you know what I mean? And I think that is a problem, in my opinion, at least, to qualify it by saying this is my opinion, my personal opinion, that the way that you could say the Labour leadership, let's not pin it on Jeremy Corbyn, as a lot of people have been doing, the way the Labour leadership dealt with the anti-Semitism problem wasn't great. And this comes as a former member of the Labour Party, who joined because, you know, I felt invigorated by Corbyn, a fresh face, new policies, someone we can all rally behind. But I think it could have been dealt in a much better way. Did he have his opponents? Did Did he have people that didn't like him? Did he have people that wanted him out of the party? Did he have people that thought he was way too radical? Absolutely. But I don't think that takes away from the anti-Semitism problem that was within the Labour Party ranks. And I think in order for the Labour Party to move on...
So what's going to happen to him now? Now that he's appealing.
Appealing the decision.
He's appealing it and he's fighting it. I guess the other question that comes out, right? A lot of young people, I think, possibly including yourself, Hamda, were attracted to the Labour Party.
Are we not young? Are you not young?
I'm getting old now.
No, you guys are on the bit older scale of young. There's different ranges of youth here.
See, Mustafa, why did you have to do it? Why did you have to do this to us, right? Why did you have to rub the salt in? But anyway,
at least I've got a full hairline. At least I've got a full hairline.
My point was going to be, I think a lot of young people were attracted to the Labour Party because of Corbyn. They were invigorated, as you were many, many years ago, Mustafa, and as you were potentially more recently, Hamda. But what do you think now? So what would you do, Hamda, if Jeremy Corbyn is no longer part of the Labour Party, or he starts up his own party, like, you know, what's his name, Mr. Galloway did? What would you do?
I think for me, one, besides the whole identity politics, which I detest, because you're rather than going for the policies of some party, you're going for the individual, like it's some like popularity contest, which really it shouldn't be. But I think if Corbyn's policies, if he did set up a new party, aligned with my own and how I wanted to see the UK going, then by all means, I would join the party. But the current Labour Party really doesn't actually, it doesn't really reach out to me as a young person in terms of the policies, in terms of being radical or whatever. I really just don't like the new leadership and the way that it's going and things like that. So I would probably just stay clear of it.
That's an indictment of Labour from
our... Well, to be honest, I would make that statement even under Jeremy Corbyn. I think it got to a point with myself, actually, where even See, I don't like to associate the parties with individual leaderships. I think that's the way the country is going. We're going to a more presidential style political system. Some guy just slashed me in the face, but I'm sitting in the car. I can't even complain. Going back to the point where we are becoming sort of very, very individualistic in terms of our politics, where it is Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, it is Boris Johnson's Conservative Party. Whatever it is, I think that's we should go back to what it was like before, where you're voting for policy, you're voting for a party, you're not voting for an individual. So sitting here talking about Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party or whatever it is, I don't like that. Yes, at the end of the day, he was the leader and the buck stops with the leader. But even under the previous regime, you know, call it the regime as a whole, towards the end, I started to get disenfranchised with the Labour Party, even under Jeremy Corbyn.
I guess to take that point forward on the presidential election system, there is, across the pond, there's very interesting things happening. And we said we'd talk about that in more detail, possibly in a future episode with a guest from across the pond. But what are your guys' thoughts on US elections happening right now and kind of the way the campaign has been run and there's so much vitriol? And of course, Muslim Twitter went crazy when Biden said inshallah once. And it was like, you guys are missing the point completely.
I think that's just American Muslims, to be honest.
I think it was not just America.
In response to your question, my response is la hawla wala quwwata illa billah, because honestly, if we have another 4 years of Trump, Allah's plan must be great, because I don't think that us humans can deal with 4 years of Trump. But if Biden were to win, I'm not even sure how that would look like, because I don't know, he doesn't really inspire passion within myself. I mean, I'm from UK, so I can't really speak for American Muslims. But yeah, I just don't see the passion in him. I think people just want to vote for him because he was vice president to Barack Obama for 8 years.
No, I don't think it's that. I think it's anything but Trump. If they put a potato against Trump, people would have voted for the potato.
There was a famous Lord Buckethead or something that stood in one of the UK elections.
Yeah, exactly. He's this famous character that always runs in the seat where the sitting prime minister is running.
Yeah.
I think in America, and again, we qualify this by saying we are living in the UK. We can't speak for.
We have our own Boris Johnson.
We've got our own problems
that we make fun of or poke fun at and things like that.
Yeah, but I think with the American people, and not all the American people, but with the more progressive side of the American population, they are. I think he's got to a point where anything but Trump. And I think that's the attitude that Muslim voters in the US should be taking anyway.
I guess there's a little bit of spillover though, because when that conversation turns nasty and, you know, Islamophobia is normalized in the American context, it kind of, or any other Western context, and I'll come to a couple of others in a minute, but like that's where it kind of seeps through, and then we feel the ramifications here. A lot of the movement building and a lot of the people, like, you know, Nigel Farage helps and consulted with Trump during the elections, and then he was back here.
He was on stage with him a few days ago.
Yeah.
He was on stage with him.
It's a lot of the same people in the far right groups who really don't like people who are comfortable with their Muslim identities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, and I don't think it's just Muslims. I think it's minorities in general.
Yeah, I think everyone's just become really fed up with how he's dealt with COVID, how he's dealt with the anti-blackness and like police brutality and all of that stuff. So I feel like, yeah, more people are actually voting. I think I was watching the news a couple of days ago and it said there's more people voting in this year's election than there was in 2016. So that just shows you that more people have a fire under their belly.
That was early votes.
The general election, yeah, the early votes,
that
yeah.
The amount of people that have voted early has already smashed 2016 records, and I think there's still a few days left for early voting.
Okay, it'll be an interesting. Go on.
I was going to say, after all of this, I think Donald Trump's going to win the election. I think, to be honest, that is my
predictions. In, do you know what? It's one of those things that obviously betting isn't halal, but you know, if it was theoretically, it would. I kind of agree with you. I think it's that whole, you know, it's so easy to galvanize people when there's something to be passionate about. So I think if you had like a Bernie Sanders versus Trump situation, both sides would be very galvanized, which is bad because that means the country's more polarized. But I think if you have one polarized figure and one centrist figure, there's a few people who really believe in the polarized figure really powerfully. And so I think it's going to swing in that side. Whereas there's too many people who are like, Biden, don't really care. I'm going to sit this one out. He doesn't inspire me enough to do anything. And the reality is that for a majority of people, Trump will not make their life that difficult. If you're not a member of a minority, you couldn't care less who's in power. And I think we've seen that in many places, right, where populist leaders come to power who say things like that, India being one of them. And if we look very directly within the West, if we turn our direction from the West over to the East, we've got right next to us France, where we have a very similar populist leader who's kind of piggybacking on this far right.
I think before we jump. You know, we've jumped over.
I did it so elegantly, though. How are you going to do this to me?
Before we jump over the channel to France, I think let's fly back over the Atlantic Ocean and go back to
America.
Back to America. That's, see how elegantly I did that. I think just to go back to the point you were saying of the amount of people that will be galvanized by the polarized figure. People underestimate not necessarily Trump, but the Trump's team to win elections and to campaign. Trump has been on the election campaign trail, arguably ever since he got elected. And that's why people say it's always hard to win against the sitting president, because essentially they've been campaigning for 4 years, whereas you've only been campaigning for, I don't know how it works in America. But
saying that Trump is special anyway, right?
Well, in many different ways. Look back at when the Black Lives Matter happened, when he went on his little stroll and held the Bible and outside the church. That was, I mean, a lot of people laughed at it, rightly so, because it was, I don't know what you want to call it, but it was a bit one of them freak dictator moments that you see in people doing in the Middle East and whatever it is. But he was sending a message to his to the right of his party, or to the to the right of his party, saying that I'm here. I'm, you know, the Bible is what guides us, or whatever it is. And look at all these people trying to attack the church and attack our values, and I'm here defending it. That's the way I saw it.
On that sense, though, I feel like, look, the Bible's like a Judeo-Christian tradition is very similar to our tradition. So in that sense, on one hand, I'm like, you know what? Firstly, I like that this guy's straight up, because, and a lot of people say this, right, is that they like that he's, it's just there, right? His view is out there. There's no two-faced business, or, you know, like Barack Obama, yes, okay, everything good, but then turns out drone strikes multiplied by, you know, tenfold or something. So a lot of people were like very disenfranchised with the Democrats anyway. And then plus it comes to all this thing about, you know, at least he's bringing, or a lot of his core bring some conservative values that we can agree with, you know, the importance of a nuclear family, taking care of certain elders, that kind of thing, bringing God back into the
country. Yeah, even if he doesn't believe it in himself.
Yeah, at least a lot of his core. And the I guess the problem for us is that if we're brown people, these white people can agree with you, or these predominantly white people, these Christian conservatives, can agree with you in everything else you say, but they hate you because of the color of your skin.
But it's also the fact that he has also, how many Catholics has he appointed on the Supreme Court? Like three, is it? And that's what he campaigned for at the beginning. And I was watching some videos on how a lot of his supporters, they truly feel passionate about the fact that he has not lied on the fact that he was going to do certain things, and he's done it. And I'm just,
has he really done it?
I'm not sure, but to them he has. To them it feels like he has, as long as it perceived to be that he's done what he was going to say. To them it's like, hey, we won, in essence, you know what I mean? So
he's firing up his base. He's firing up his base. He's garnering support from millions and millions of people. I think that the term that they use is the silent majority. He's speaking to that very silent majority. And I think a lot of people, especially on the left side of the political spectrum and the liberal side and those like that, like to call themselves progressives. I think both extremes are bad. Extreme left is bad. Extreme right is bad. We should firmly be working in the center of the political spectrum, even the economic spectrum. I think we're taught that as Muslims. We choose the middle path every single time. I think a lot of the left and the progressives are sort of giving themselves a very false sense of security. And I think, God knows, you know, we can't
false
tell.
False sense of security, how so? In that they're very conscious in the sense that Biden
might win. Yeah, that Biden's leading in the polls. People hate Trump. Trump is...
it was the same back in 2016 when Hillary was leading.
The same as the back in 2016. Biden's got this. And I don't think that's the case. I don't think that's the case. So if anything, they should continue campaigning to the very last minute. They should continue pushing people to get out and vote until whatever deadline day or deadline time they have in the USA on election day, and not fall into that false sense of security. You fall into that false sense of security, you get complacent, and the other side isn't being complacent.
The other point that I kind of wanted to touch upon was, ultimately, a lot of where you vote depends on your socioeconomic background, and some of the stats say that Muslims in Britain tend to be generally lower socioeconomic backgrounds than Muslims in America. A lot of people who emigrated, because again, in both countries, actually, the majority of the populations are immigrant communities from the Middle East or South Asia, etc. And there are America has a big inherent community, which is Black Muslims or African American Muslims, not Black immigrants, who are actually more of the poorer people. But that has led to how they have relationships with different parties. Muslims in the U.S. traditionally voted Republican until they started voting Democrat in recent decades, whereas in the UK it's been the opposite. You know, we've been safe Labour voters for God knows how long.
I think that
do you think a shift will come as Muslims rise in the socioeconomic
I don't think it's socioeconomy. I think that A bit of it is socioeconomy, definitely. There is that theory of you start off as a young person voting for the socialists because they give you handouts, they give you money to help you along, and once you grow up and you have your own house and you've got
no, but it's also your interest, right? Is one of the reasons people were against Corbyn was, you know, if you're making over 80 grand a year, your taxes are going to increase. Nobody likes their taxes to increase.
I think that's a very it's a quagmire that I don't think we have time to get into in this particular episode, because we could sit here talking about that for a very long time. I think going back to the question of if, as Muslims, our, you know, socioeconomic status rises, will we shift away from Labour? I don't think it's that. I think it's to do with your how solid or how comfortable you are with your identity. If you speak to a lot of them, and again, this is just the American Muslims that I've spoken to. If you speak to a lot of American Muslims, they're very comfortable in their Americanness, if you want to say that. And that's maybe because America, you know, in and of itself, it's a very patriotic country. They push this whole sense of America and all of that. And that,
yeah, the land maybe, of the free.
Yeah, the land of the free, the home of the brave, and all of that stuff. Don't know how free it is now, but they push that a lot. And I think that gets embedded within your identity, whether you're a Muslim or a non-Muslim or a Black American or a white American. Whereas here in the UK, I think a lot of us, well, our generation at least, we're still first or second generation, where we still have this thought going on in our head. Wait, are we Pakistani? Are we Somalian? Are we Arab? Or wherever we come from. And that has led to a lot of the Muslim population not necessarily engaging with politics here in the UK, whereas our generation growing up now, we're very sort of firm in, you could say, our Britishness, in our British Muslim identity. And it's allowing us to open our eyes a bit more, to study the political parties, to study their manifestos. I think ultimately it comes down to political education. I don't know if that's the right,
so,
right word.
Political consciousness amongst young people. That's a key. And also being firm in your own identity, because like you've said, I think with us here, we don't, well, for me personally, I don't have that firm conviction of like the British Muslim, you know what I mean? I'm first and foremost where I'm from, because I'm, I guess, first generation immigrant, because like whatever, because it's the second thing. But with America, it's completely different. I think that's more patriotic, and you can't be anything else but American. But over here, I guess you can be something else but British, because we have a multicultural society. That's
which
what we
is beautiful. I think, which is what's fantastic about this country. You have this mesh of different cultures and mesh of different identities that have come together and arguably formed a new identity, which is what the far right doesn't really like.
Do you think a lot of Americans would agree with you? Because surely they'd say that they've actually accepted a lot of, if you think about Britain now, right, most people who think of Britain, they still think of, you know, the Queen and rich white people having high tea.
Yeah, but you also think of curry and like fish and chips.
Yeah, chicken masala. And you also think of, chicken masala was made in Birmingham. Was it in Birmingham? I think it was in Birmingham. But I think that's what sets us apart from a lot of the countries. I think a lot of young people and a lot of minorities in general like to sit and bash Britain. But if you compare it to other countries in the West, we actually have it pretty good here. If you look in America, they've got this demagogue idiot in Trump who's unapologetically racist, who's unapologetically
so is our guy Nikabis, no, look like letterboxes. That's unapologetically racist.
Yeah, of course.
And
of
we
course,
just talked about the inquiry that cleared him of any wrongdoing and said Islamophobia isn't even a problem in the Conservative Party.
Yeah, no, of course. But that I think speaks to a wider shift in the world view of shifting to the right. But going back to the point of how we have it much better than a lot of our Muslim I'm not going to say comrades because I really don't like that word.
It's very easy to call you an Uncle Tom for this line of speaking, right?
Okay, go for it. Call me an Uncle Tom.
No. I
understand what is an Uncle Tom?
It's kind of when you sell out, right? When you sell out and you're just kind of giving up your community for.
Yeah, but honestly, we do have it good.
I haven't given up.
Look at what's going on in France. that's going on, what's in the rest of European countries, especially in America as well. Like with us here, yes, we have racism. Yes, we have certain problems.
We can still, our girls and women can still wear the hijab. I can get out a prayer mat and pray right now in the middle of the road. No one will say anything to me. They might give me a dirty look, but, you know, they'll be like, oh, what's this weirdo doing? But that's because they're not that educated. But again, look in France, women aren't allowed to wear hijab. Was it Belgium? They recently passed a law banning hijab from educational institutes. Look at Hungary with Viktor Orban. Look at Belarus with their dictator that he's refusing to leave after the elections. Look at Russia. And I think we sometimes take that for granted here. In Britain, we're not without our shortcomings.
On the other side,
British racism is very different to other forms of racism in the sense that it's very, very subtle, and definitely the society is shifting more to the right, and we see that.
You're focusing very much on overt small things, right? So ultimately, if someone screams at you on the street, that's very different to someone in a position of authority not hiring you. And we see huge pay gaps.
Power. Racism is power. It's power that one person has over another person because they do not like the color of their skin. And I don't think Mustafa is disputing that exists in Britain. It, of course, does because of work, education, all of that.
Doesn't that exist more in Britain than, for example, a place like America?
I mean, yes, because the British are subtle. But
power is hugely concentrated in certain sectors in Britain. And even I would say certain families and stuff. Whereas in America, it seems that
is controlled by corporations.
Yeah, but a lot of these corporations are headed by you know, brown and black people, by BAME people. And again, this is becoming a race conversation,
In America, it's not.
I mean, if you look at some major companies, right, like Google comes to mind, PepsiCo comes to mind.
Look at the top 10 or top 20 rich list in America. It's all families as well. It's all families. The family that owns Walmart, Warren Buffett, Jeff Bezos.
Warren Buffett is not family rich. Warren Buffett is self rich. Jeff Bezos is self rich. He comes from a middle class. Well, upper middle class family. No,
they're not selfish. Let's dismantle this argument of they're self-made and they made
work from the bottom.
They didn't work from the bottom, but they worked from the middle. Jeff Bezos, the Bill Gates, all of these people who have made their billions. I don't know much about Warren Buffett because arguably he's not our generation, and he's made his money not in tech but in stocks. But if you look at all these people, they're not self-made. They came from pretty well off middle class families, and they had the privilege of their parents being able to give them startup loans, to give them a garage to work out of. Whereas the majority of people,
well off middle class is not equal richest guy in the world.
Sorry, say that again.
Like well off middle class does not.
It's also different to working four jobs, not having the time to actually work on the dream that you want.
I'm not denying that there was some level of privilege. All I was saying was that. Anyways, I think we're dissecting a random point about we're digressing quite a lot.
We digress. Going back to the point you're saying that in Britain,
essentially, my point was yes, okay, maybe things are better overtly in Britain, but actually underneath we have the same wage gaps and divisions and all of those things. We have segregation within our society. In Birmingham, you can drive from one area to another, and you're just gonna be like, what just happened? Yep. It's like I'm in a different country.
Yeah, it's like driving. It's like living in Solihull and then moving from Solihull and living in central Birmingham.
Yeah, and even within central Birmingham, you'll have like some areas and some
different areas. Like for example, like Moseley is completely different to Walsall Heath. Kingsey is completely different.
But the thing is, I 100% agree with that, and I wasn't really. That wasn't my point. My point was more on religious freedoms.
Yeah.
On religious freedoms, overtly or not overtly again going back to France, going back to look what's happening in France, in the UK. Gladly we don't have cartoons of our prophet being published and mocked and projected onto government buildings. Our women are allowed to wear the hijab. They will be discriminated against. Yes, they might get dirty looks and whatnot, but they're still given.
I take slight issue with you saying our women. No.
Why are we not
the sisters of you?
Yeah, no, it's just patriarchal language, bro.
No.
Yeah, but what we I'm saying... are, in essence, brothers and sisters in Islam, and women were created from the rib of Adam. So our women, you men need to take responsibility of the women and protect them. So Mustafa, yes, our women.
Yes. Oh, she said it better than me. You're just, I don't know. You've joined this Smash the Patriarchy Men Are Trash movement. Hashtag Men Are Trash. So we put that in our in the description of our podcast. But yeah, but back to the point, we have those freedoms here in the UK that arguably are being stripped bit by bit, away from our brothers and sisters.
Yeah, and that was my kind of thing. Is yes, definitely we have it much better, but at the same time we can't be complacent.
Of course, 100%. I agree with you. And this is, yeah, we got, and if we go no, just on that sense of not getting complacent, if we go back to the words of Killer Mike, who said this at the sort of in the peak of the BLM movement, sort of in the spring, where he goes, I'm paraphrasing because I don't know exactly what he said, but organize, unionize, come together, campaign, and that we shouldn't get confused. We have it. Arguably, the freedoms in the UK are being squeezed. Let's not get complacent. The UK has been shifting to the right for a very, very long time, and we need to bring it back into the centre. When I say we, I mean we as British citizens, British people, we need to bring a narrative back into the centre, and we cannot get complacent, and that's what we need to do. As it's our duty as Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe we need to take it a bit to the left. But coming to France, kind of the recent developments, but also it seems interesting because the impression that a lot of people have is that France has and we did an episode on this, I think it was episode 37, where we actually interviewed someone from France, the head of a student organization over there. And some of the things were, it was a little bit eye-opening, but we got some feedback from our listeners saying that things in France seem pretty bad because, for example, women can't wear hijab in public schools until the age of 16, things like that. And I think that kind of a community that's under so much pressure. Like I've heard from friends who are like, even if you live in Paris, in some areas, if you want to pray inside of your house, you draw the curtains before you start praying because you don't want the neighbors to see you praying. Whereas like Mustafa gave a very apt example is in Britain, you don't really have a problem. You'll just pray on the street and that's not really considered a problem, or everyone down the road might know that, you know, this house is a Muslim family. In fact, we'll probably advertise it. Like, you know, I send Eid cards to all my neighbors. So we have a lot more kind of cohesiveness around us. And I think obviously we should strive to. But France seems to be a different place altogether. And my impression when Macron first got elected was this guy is not so far right populist. I don't know if
I think now he has to, because isn't it coming up for a re-election?
Yeah.
So he has to at least get his votes from somewhere. And what's the best form of, you know, taking the freedoms of one person in like one community where, you know, another hates them?
And it just shows that it's kind of an easy vote winner, right? Just bash the Muslims down the street and, you know, you'll get.
Yeah, I think it's more subtle than that. I think it's a deeper problem than that. I don't think it's just Macron trying to win votes from Marie Le Pen's supporters. France has this militant sort of extremist secularism, and I think it's that. I think this is something he genuinely believes. I think this is something he genuinely believes, and it's the Muslims today, it will be the Sikhs tomorrow, it will be the Hindus next, and it will be every single religious symbol in France has that militant secularism. You see how in the UK it's widely believed it's a Christian country. You have the Archbishop, you have the
Queen is the defender of the faith.
Yeah, you've got the Anglican Church, you've got the Church of England, yada yada yada, all of that. And in America, it's deeply Catholic, and in Italy, it's deeply Catholic. I think in France, their religion.
By the way, America is not deeply Catholic.
It is.
But that's a side point.
I stand to be corrected. Evangelical Christians maybe. But I stand to be corrected. Yeah. But with France, for lack of a better term, I think their religion is secularism.
And I think that's absolutely what it is. Even though and again it's a very militant form of secularism, because America, for example, is technically a secular country, right? Not in the same way that Britain is. Britain is a Christian country that is now being secularized. In America, the people are predominantly Christian, and actually practicing Christianity is more dominant there than in the UK. But actually, America was founded on secularism because they saw what these Protestants and Anglicans and Catholics are doing to each other. But France is very different and very militant in secularism. And in their colonialism was very unique. It's hard to draw comparisons because
it was horrible.
Of course,
their colonialism was arguably, I mean, colonialism was bad all across the board. Don't get me.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
Let's just put that out there. Colonialism was horrible. It was horrendous. But arguably, if you look at history, and again, I stand to be corrected by those who have studied it. But if you look at the atrocities that France committed in its quote unquote colonies, it is much worse than what we than any other.
I mean, partly Belgium gave them a run for their money in the Congo.
Yeah, Belgium.
Yeah, but Belgium speaks French as well, so
Britain and India.
So you're just grouping them. Very nice. I like this painting in the same brush. That's unacceptable,
bro. Yeah, but what Britain did in India, what the Dutch did in their colonies was horrible. But if you look at what France did in the Congo, what France did in Algeria, what France did in a lot of Africa was absolutely horrible. What they did in the streets of Paris to Algerians who were protesting, who are pro-Algerian independence, they murdered them and they threw them in the river. And this isn't that long ago. When people think of colonialism, they think to the late 1800s and whatever it is. I don't have the exact date.
I mean, if you have any Algerian friends, they might have grandparents who either fought or potentially relatives who died in the civil war, and this was only two generations ago, right? It was in the 50s. So it's very raw as well. And so to have that sort of community being told that, firstly, not only have we in recent memory, in living memory for some people, we've destroyed and butchered your lands, but also now you're going to come to our lands and you better do what we're telling you, and we're going to make fun of your religion and you better be okay with that. It's disgusting.
It's colonialism in another way. What's the word? I don't know how to call it, but it's more, a mental sort of colonialism, where they want to not just colonize your, and I'm going to sound very woke when I say this, they don't want to just colonize your lands, they want to colonize your minds as well. Yeah. They want to colonize the way you think and the way you
speak. I think the nuance that people need to get is saying that and having that position about French society and finding Charlie Hebdo and other cartoons of this nature abhorrent does not mean that you're defending the killer of Samuel Paty or this recent stabber in the church or any other violence. Of course not. You can have an opinion. Exactly. You can have an opinion and not be a crazed maniac.
Of course. And I think this comes back to the whole argument of freedom of speech. I think with what Muslims are saying is, we're not against freedom of speech per se. Just don't be insulting. Don't incite hatred or insult people. Freedom of speech does not mean I can come and insult your mother. I can't go up to the street.
Can I ask a question?
Go for it.
It's just something that's popped into my mind. Would it be the same if, I don't know, another religious sect or someone defaced the name of Jesus or like an image of Jesus? Because images do exist for Jesus, but would it be the same?
Of course,
like I think feeling as Christians.
I personally don't think I can answer that because I'm not a Christian. But speaking from a Muslim context, if someone was to deface Jesus on the cross, or if someone was to deface a Hindu deity that Hindus find very holy, I think we should, as Muslims, stand up for them. We should say, look, hang on, this is something that they find holy, that they find that is very, very special to them. Don't deface it. Don't insult it.
I think it's important to make a distinction though between the Hindu deity and Jesus, because Jesus, we find him holy too. It's not a kind of
he's our prophet.
Exactly. 100%. So it's just because modern day Christians, especially in Europe, and actually it's not true for all Christians, actually it's European Christians specifically, are kind of okay with making jokes out of Jesus and Adam and Eve and that kind of thing. That doesn't make it okay. And that doesn't mean, just because someone doesn't get offended by something doesn't mean that that thing can no longer be offensive to anyone, right?
Exactly.
And there was that thing of like, how did the French not get the irony of this? Was there was a person wiping his bottom with the French flag, and that was criminalized almost right away because this guy put it on social media. And it's like, look, you know, the French ultimately freedom of expression comes to a point where you're offending people, and there's no use doing that. And that's
when you're offending people, when you're inciting to violence, when you're inciting to hate, when you're inciting to all of this negative stuff. I think there should be a limit to what you there shouldn't be a limit to what you can say, but again, there should be. You know, you can say whatever you want. You can say whatever you want, provided you don't cross certain lines. Like I said, freedom of expression does not give me the excuse to stop a random man in the street and insult his mother. It doesn't give me an excuse to violate people's what people find holy, what people find. I mean, even we're taught in Islam, and I don't know, we're taught in Islam in the Quran and the Sunnah as don't insult people, or they might come back at you and insult you 10 times worse, and they will insult your religion. It's in the Quran, it's an ayah, and I'm not 100% certain on the ayah, but we'll certainly put it in the description of the podcast or out in the tweets when the Muslims are commanded, when they're talking about Quraysh and they're talking about the idols that Quraysh used to worship.
Don't make fun of their idols, or they'll make fun of yours, and that's worse.
Yeah, don't make fun of their idols. Don't make fun of what they believe in, or they might, because they will come back and they will make fun of the Prophet and they will make fun of Allah, and arguably to us that's so much worse.
I have a last kind of question before we wrap up. Is the bedrock of this conversation that kind of we've had, we've said that essentially, as long as you don't harm someone else or you don't incite to hatred, so there's a risk of harm to someone else, it's fine. You can say whatever you want. That grounding is not essentially true in Islam, right? Because in Islam, there is such a thing as you're not allowed to insult certain sacred objects, even if nobody's getting offended. It's not the fact that people are getting offended, it's the fact that God is much higher, and therefore there are some symbols that it's unacceptable for you to come after. So even if there was no one to get offended, it's still unacceptable. And I think it's interesting that the argument that we've made is from is how the French are hypocrites from their own secular roots, but actually from an Islamic perspective, we don't even need to follow these arguments, because for us, these symbols are sacred. Or from any godly perspective, actually, these symbols are sacred because they're symbols of God, and you shouldn't make fun of them. Full stop.
No, but I think, look, by saying you can say what you want, I'm not advocating that you go and insult deities, you insult holy symbols. But at the end of the day, as Muslims, we believe that the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam has one, someone who is much greater that can defend him. That doesn't mean we don't defend him. That means we do all we can to protect the honor of our Prophet, to protect his image and his name. But we also have that belief and have that comfort in our hearts that at the end of the day, there is Allah to protect the Prophet. There is Allah to protect the religion. There is Allah to protect those who need to be protected. Islam, yes. We should, there is limits to what we can say, and we are taught what we can say and what we shouldn't say. But I don't think we should then be going around, if that's what we believe, 100%. But then we shouldn't go around imposing that on other people, lest we become like the French.
So you're saying that just because we have the principles not to degrade and mock others, we shouldn't impose that on them? Because that's not what they believe.
Sorry, say that again.
So like you were saying that in our deen, we're taught not to, like, I don't know, incite hatred or whatever. So that means like freedom of speech, basically. We're not, if we are limited in our freedom of speech because we know there's principles behind it, just because that they do not believe in our, you know, deen.
I don't think we're limited in our freedom of speech as Muslims. I don't think we're limited in our freedom of thoughts or expressions. I think, on the contrary, Islam encourages us to be inquisitive, encourages us to ask questions, encourages us to be very open in what we say, to hold our scholars to account, to hold our you know, the powers that be to account. But I think what I'm trying to say is,
I think absolutely because we are.
Because we have a certain set of values.
No, we have a certain set of values, so we don't go. But ultimately, if you choose to follow Islam, you are absolutely diminishing your freedom of speech. And we're okay with that. And we think that's important.
Yes, of course, because Islam in and of itself means to submit, to surrender.
I was just taking issue with that point where you said that Islam doesn't limit our freedom of speech. It absolutely does.
I don't think it does. I don't think it does.
Can we explain what we're being limited by, though? Because I think we have different understandings of what we're being limited by. What do you mean we're not limited? What is exactly are we not being limited?
I think what Thaqib was saying was that in Islam, we are taught, you know, we are taught that certain things are untouchable, they're holy. Allah, the Prophet, to some even the Sahaba and the Tabi'een, and, you know, the companions of the Prophets and the companions of the companions, those that came after them. I think Thaqib was saying that in Islam, we are taught that certain things are untouchable. And 100%, I agree with that. But then to others, they are touchable. And when people do come and, you know, insult or incite our deities and our prophets and our God, 100% we should stand up and we should correct. But then we shouldn't go as far to impose our beliefs and our values against other people's wills. There's no compulsion in religion at the end of the day. The
okay, way I that was my original question. Does that mean that just because we can't impose them, does it not mean that we should also take the liberty to explain to them, look, listen, this is our holy scripture, or this is something that is sacred to us. Could you please respect that? It's a respect.
That's what we should be doing. And that's what we should be doing. And that's what we should be doing. We should be raising awareness as to why this is holy to us. Why, you know, at the end of the day, look, fundamentally, and this is very, very controversial, what I'm going to say, will be very controversial to a lot of Muslims. If some cartoonist wants to draw a cartoon of the Prophet, that's between them and themselves. You know, do what you want. I think where I draw the line is when a president of a state comes and projects it onto a building where they run it 24/7 in your face, as if they're trying to offend you on purpose. At the end of the day,
the editor of a magazine is trying to do it on purpose. So why is it? I get what you're saying is you've basically drawn an arbitrary line and said, look, when a head of state does it, it's unacceptable. But if a magazine does it, it's fine.
No, I'm not. It's still not fine. It's still not fine. But at the end of the day, look at Charlie Hebdo. It was a magazine that was very limited in circulation. It was some reports say that it was going to go bust.
I see that point, which is that strategically, it's terrible, terrible strategy to go after something that's so quiet. And we've seen this with every single example, right? Is those YouTube videos, nobody in the world seen them until somebody just pointed them out and then everybody went and saw them. So a lot of the time, even with this, like, you know, when you're sharing something for awareness, actually a lot of these search engines and stuff, they calculate how many times something has been cited, and by sharing it, you're citing it. So strategically, it doesn't make sense. But I think there's an interesting, and while you were speaking there, I was like, that seems to be a little bit of a contradiction, because you're saying we shouldn't impose it on them, but then you are imposing it on them, right? If you say that they have the right to do whatever they want, so they should do whatever they want, fine, don't go to France, right? And let the French do what they want. That's what the right wing wants you to do. On the other hand, you're saying, no, we should correct them. So which one kind of is it? And
we should, at the end of the day, the way I see it as Muslims, our duty is to deliver the message, to correct them, to tell them how we feel, to try and bring about change, to explain to them. But at the end of the day, we cannot impose our will. We cannot impose our values on people that don't want it. And here, I don't think
telling someone not to make fun of you and saying, do not make this cartoon, otherwise we're going to, and again, we should follow non-violent normative means, like something like boycott or something. And boycott, actually, maybe we overuse it sometimes and their effectiveness is...
No, but it's 100%, it's working now with France.
But my point is...
They've lost 28 billion in a
day. My point is doing something like this... doing something like this is different. Of course, we're not saying we're advocating direct action, but if you're saying, so your point that people have the freedom to do whatever they want, Well, if they do, okay, maybe you conveyed your message. This guy's not interested and he wants to make cartoons of you. By your logic, leave him alone.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, we can't, like, we don't have control over everybody.
We don't have control over what they do. We don't have control over what they do. But my point is we absolutely should apply pressure to them because this is unacceptable, right? Just because you have freedom doesn't mean you can go and, you know, make fun of me all the time. This thing is affecting me directly, even by their values. So that's why I think it's not an imposition of my values on you to say you can't produce this cartoon. It's just you recognizing that I am an equal member of this society, and that's the global society. And so if you do this...
Yeah, I think in that aspect, for me, what's coming back is even if French Muslims were to directly or indirectly say to the French state or whoever, please do not be doing any of this. Has it worked? No. Will it work? No, because I think it's all about, like you said, Muslims in French society are not probably treated as equal members of the society because of the fact that they're Muslim. So in that aspect, you're just, in my viewpoint right now, hearing you guys talk, is they're fighting a fight that they can't necessarily win.
So should they leave France and make hijrah?
No, hell no. They should fight to stay because those people were born in France, like generations were born in France. They grew up in France. They speak French. So no, just sure. Because, you know, but what can they do? That's the thing.
No, and I think what in terms of what they can do or what Muslims across the world can do. And I think this could be a sort of a good point to end on, sort of a call to action about these cartoons, is the boycott that we're seeing happening to French products. It's very, very effective, and we see within a day or two.
I actually don't agree with that point, by the way, because you say that it's been effective. Okay, some French brands have been hit, but a lot of French brands are publicly traded, and that's a problem with most boycotts, right? Firstly, they're not strategic.
But it is worked because the French state has taken attention straight away and it released a statement literally a day or two after saying, please don't boycott our products. The people who are boycotting it are extremists. When it's not.
I agree with the French response, but I don't think at the same time boycotts are always I'm not advocating that we don't boycott. Actually, anyone who's listened to this podcast long enough knows that I'm on every side of every point. But my point with boycotts was a lot of the time the people you're harming are stockholders, and those stockholders can be from anywhere.
Yeah, and then the stockholders
and boycotts tend to be very non-strategic. So there have been cases
of control of the company.
Firstly, that company may or may not have done anything, but two, and more importantly, a lot of the time, a lot of other products. So, for example, in Pakistan, there was a case of this biscuit company that shared a name
Let me rein you in here. No one's talking about, I mean, with all respect to Pakistan and Pakistani biscuits, no one's talking about random boycotts that are unstrategic, that have no thought behind them. We're talking about targeted boycotts that have a particular target. The idea of boycotting French products.
My point is just that this boycott of French products, where people just send WhatsApp lists, does not come across as a strategic targeted boycott.
Yeah, but okay,
targeted boycott. You're boycotting specific products made by specific French brands that, in turn, these shareholders, these stockholders,
I was just going to say, if I was a business owner, let's say of one of the French corporations that was hit by the boycott, I will then be going to the French prime minister, whatever his name is, Macron, saying, listen, my company, my organization is getting hit. Do something about this. Business at the end of the day runs politicians. Politicians need money, and that means money comes from businesses. So if I, as a business, has a lot of stockholders and shares and also contribute to the economy, mate, as a prime minister, I'm going to be like, you know what? My economy is being hit by this boycott.
Look at the French markets over the past week. It's all red arrows going down, 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 down. At the end of the day, who donates to these political parties? Who donates to Macron? Who donates to Le Pen? It's people who own these corporations in the country they live in. If he's being hit in his pocket, he's going to turn around to say, so-and-so is going to turn around to Macron and say, mate, look, I can't donate to your next re-election campaign because I don't have that much money, because you were so stupid and you went and offended 1.8 billion people in the world, and they were the main market of my product. if you think, I think in Morocco there was this interesting stat. In Morocco there was a boycott of Danone. It's a French brand, and as a result of the boycott, Danone lost 20% of its market share in milk in Morocco. That's a massive long term hit. 20% of a market share is a massive,
especially massive during COVID.
Exactly, and Macron is coming up for re-election. That these businesses, the whole idea is that these businesses turn around and say to Macron, "Dude, stop. It's hurting our pockets, and if it hurts our pockets, it hurts our French economy." He doesn't want the French economy to tank, because what's he going to say to his people? Oh, sorry, French economies are tanked because I was so hard-headed. I didn't want to accept that I'd made a mistake and that I'd done something stupid.
Yeah, I think a lot of these things, they have a tendency to entrench certain ideas as well. So I think evidence-based, I think ultimately we end up boycotting because there's not much else we can do. But at the same time, it's not a and again, in this case, it's been called for by certain countries. But at the same time, sometimes it's not.
I mean, if we integrate boycotting, education, and also like some other form of action, it will have a long lasting impact, because one, you're doing it on where it hurts, money, and educating the public about what's going on and why it's being done. Because I think that's what these podcasts, like social media campaigns, webinars, whatever's being, that's all it.
Yeah, I think that is an excellent kind of point to end on. I think it would be good to do a further episode on a few of these points. We talked about US elections, we talked about France in particular, but also the efficacy of boycotts and whether or not they actually achieve what they're supposed to. So I think this has been nice. It's been intense.
Definitely.
And we've definitely got...
As you can see in the background, it's just going darker and darker.
If you live in a random street and you just heard some guy screaming inside of his car, then that probably means that Mustafa's one of your neighbors. So we apologize to you for ruining your...
Do you apologize because I'm their neighbor, or do you apologize...
No, I apologize if they got scared by some random guy screaming in their car. It's been a good podcast. Hopefully we have a lot more coming out with a lot more regularity. So we're back, and we're back and we're hitting the ground running. And we will see you very soon with another episode of the Middle West Podcast. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.